It's one thing falling in love with a house, picturing yourself moving in and calling it home, and quite another navigating the world of price negotiating, mortgage lenders, and finding the budget that works best for you. An agent who's a Realtor can make understanding that world easier. Realtors have the expertise, access to proprietary data, and tools to help you get from imagining living somewhere to actually doing it. That's the kind of help we can provide. Because that's who we are. Realtors are members of the National Association of Realtors.
Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at Curology.com/SXM. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation, subscription required. Cancel anytime.
What's good, y'all? This is Breeze Brewing from the Mighty Juggernauts. And make sure you subscribe and download the podcast, Library Rap, the hip-hop interviews with Tim Einenkel. Hip-hop journalism on the highest level.
Yeah, what's up? It's your boy, Joel Ortiz. And I want everybody to make sure that they subscribe and download the podcast, Library Rap, the hip-hop interviews with Tim Einenkel. Yo, Tim, I hope all is well. You my guy. I know these interviews are not interviews. They're actually conversations, and I appreciate them all. Yalla.
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Ice-T. I want you to do something for me. Make sure you download and subscribe Library Rap, the hip-hop interviews with Tim Einenkel. It is official. All right? Stop playing. Download and subscribe. Library Rap, the hip-hop interviews with Tim Einenkel. It's cold.
My next guest seems to be creating music all the time. With 25-plus projects under his belt, including his latest album, The Fun Ones, which dropped in April, he is RJD2, and I want to welcome him to the Library with Tim Einenkel and allhiphop.com. RJD2, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Thank you. So I have to go back. Prior to 1997, you were a 20-year-old in Columbus, Ohio, trying to make beats while waiting tables. And then Akai introduced the MPC 2000. What did this mean to you?
Well, for guys like me, it was a huge deal, mostly because of the price point. So up until that moment, if you wanted to make beats, you effectively had two options of machines you could buy. One was the Akai MP60 and the other was the ASR10. And the MPC60 at the time was over $3,000. And if I remember correctly, I want to say the ASR was around $2,500, $3,000-ish, something like that. And you know, for anybody that's working a minimum wage ish job, those are almost unattainable price points. So, I remember it being a pretty big deal when Akai came out with the MPC 2000, and the price point was, I think the retail was like $1,400, and if you sweet talked the guy at Guitar Center down, you could get it for $1,250, $1,300, something like that. So that was actually an amount of money that I could save up. And that's what I did. I saved up that money from waiting tables and, bought the machine. And, I vividly remember I had a family vacation like the weekend after I bought it. And I really didn't know how the machine worked. But it was a blessing in disguise because I went away and I couldn't take the machine. So I took the manual. And I read the manual every word front to back before I really had any experience on the machine. So when I got back that weekend, I was really kind of off and running. I felt like I was pretty familiar with all the functionality of the machine. It was just a matter of digging in.
Before I ask you about kind of the functionality of this machine, as you mentioned, prior to this machine, the other machines were very expensive. How has the accessibility of the art of DJing / beat making has changed since the advancement, not just of technology, but also of affordable pricing? And do you think it has helped, has hurt the art? And it could also have helped and hurt at the same time. So let's get your thoughts on that.
You know, my personal take on it is all of the above. Honestly, I think there's an interplay between the price point and what you do with it. You know, to kind of walk that out a bit. If you have to work for months, you know, 3, 4, 5 months to save up the money to buy something, it creates kind of like a barrier to entry. And the people that are willing to do that are already by definition so serious enough about doing it, or at least giving it a shot, that you weed down the number of people that are really serious about doing it, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you fast forward to now where things are much more affordable and programs are much more affordable. It takes that barrier to entry down to not zero, but pretty damn low. I mean, you can get a MIDI keyboard for under $100. And for the most part, we treat a computer like it's a necessity in modern life, you know, at the very least an iPad or an iPhone, all of which people have made beats on. So it takes that barrier to entry down to, you know, a pair of jeans or some Air Force Ones or something. And, I think that it goes both ways, and that I think that it's great for democratizing access to the art form. And I think that that's only good. I don't think that there is, for the user, I should say, I think there is only positive effects of that. Now, on the flip side, for the listener, I think that you know, barrier to entry, and this is just me being honest, and I'm not trying, I say this with no sense of snobbery. I think that this is just kind of like an objective fact. And hopefully everyone can kind of appreciate this if you've ever really gone out and searched for music that you connect with. There's a lot more to search through now, you know, and so I think that I wouldn't say that I wouldn't use the terminology bad, but I would say that it creates a more challenging environment for listeners to find music that they connect with when there's so much music out there, you know?
Right.
So I think that it, you know, you can't really reduce it down to one side or the other, because there's, you know, it kind of depends on which lens you're looking through it at.
The MPC 2000, my understanding is that had 64 sounds you could program at any particular time.
Yeah.
When you started using it, was there anything as like kind of overthinking it or overprogramming it, like being like, I have to use all 64 of these sounds because they're giving me 64, you know, 64 banks to use?
It's funny that you use the term overthinking, because I had never really thought of it in those terms, but that is fair. You know, I mean, to be totally honest with you, I feel like I built a creative style. I don't think that there's a huge interplay between technology and art, and this is just one of those examples where having access to 64 sounds, I will never forget the very first beat I made. It was just three loops. And I remember being like, this is just three loops. I've got 61 pads left that are doing nothing. What could I do with this? And that was, in essence, the mission statement that I lived by for the next 7 or 8 years of my life, was how far can I take the technological limits of this machine. I was just trying to max the thing out as much as possible. But the term overthinking drives it at a really important part of that issue. Because I was also doing that because I had made enough beats, you know, maybe a year into it, I had made enough beats to realize that there's so many classic records that were made that are just maybe two loops or three loops. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at most of the rap that came out between 1991, not all of it, but a lot of it that came out between 91 and 99 could be made on maximum, you know, 16 pads, one bank of four banks in the MPC. And when you try to do that and do it well, you realize how really, really hard it is. I mean, one of the things that I think is so masterful about the Midnight Marauders album is it's effectively a collection of loops, but it's almost untouchable in its sonic. The selection of the loops becomes, it's so hard to pick loops that are as effective as you know, what Q-Tip picked for that record.
Right.
So my whole angle coming into it was like, I can't do that. I can't make a Come Clean. I can't make a, you know, a Electric Relaxation or so on and so forth, or anything off of, you know, Balloon Mind State or whatever. It's just, I don't have that. I can't find loops that are that dope. So I've got to find another angle. So my angle became, every song is going to have as much going into it as possible. And if I'm being perfectly honest, it's because I was trying to mask my inability to make that really effective three loop beat.
What was the, for you, what was the first kind of, I guess, beat that you made off of the MPC 2000 that you were, one, completely happy with, I mean, and two, kind of willing to share it to, you know, the public? And then also, how many pads did you use for it?
You know, the first record that I produced, I remember the very, very first beat I made was this, it was some loop. I think it was a loop, Hey Leroy, Your Mama's Calling You, with the Dynamic Corvettes drums underneath it. And I distinctly remember that was like the first week I had the machine. And, you know, these are all things that had been, you know, kind of, I don't want to say ran into the ground, but they weren't groundbreaking loops or anything. But it was, you know, it was fun and it was dope. And that was really, I remember taking it back to Guitar Center and playing the beat. Fucking stupid, but I did it. Sorry if I'm, you can bleep if you,
That's okay.
Just clean. Apologies. I'll keep it clean for the rest of it. The first beat that I really was, you know, for a while there, I was really trying to like just go hog wild. And I think June, the building blocks of June were made in that first year or two. But I remember the first record that I had my, you know, production credit on was Rocket Science 12 inch with the megahertz. And, that beat was probably the first thing that I remember, being happy with, but also it was like an extreme attempt in simplifying what I was attempting to do. I was very consciously aiming at a simplified target. And you know, over time I grew to enjoy doing that just as much as, you know, making something that's like hyper complex or whatever.
So in 2002, you signed with Definitive Jux. You released your debut album, Dead Ringer. How did the Definitive Jux connection happen? And prior to 2002, what were you? I mean, were you building up for this moment? I mean, was that the plan to be signed with a label? Was Definitive Jux going to be that label? So what was happening then?
Yeah, you know, it's a funny period to revisit in my mind. Because how I wound up there was just, you know, really kind of like by happenstance. It so came so close to not happening, that it's just wild for me to look back on. So there was a label out of the Bay Area called Bomb Hip Hop. Dave Paul ran it, and they were doing like independent hip hop. And kind of like focused on the Bay Area DJ scene and, you know, lesser degree LA. But anyway, I actually had a contract and made an album with that label, and, the album never came out. But, once I got serious about, you know, not just making beats, but trying to make beats that could live on their own without a wrapper, I started shopping demos, and that's how, you know, I had that, you know, got that deal with Bomb. But through that period, and it might have been after that thing kind of fell apart, and I would call Dave, and there was a point where he just stopped taking my calls. He just ducked me. So I was like, I think that's how I got dropped, is I couldn't get him on the phone anymore. I was like, okay, I guess that's how that's going to end. And so I was like hunting around in the Ninja Tune, Moax, Skint, so on and so forth, world of labels that were focusing on what I would call instrumental hip hop. And just having no luck at all, you know, most of the time I couldn't get a response. And I literally sent out a demo to what, to my knowledge, every single label on planet Earth that was doing that kind of music, with no luck at all. And I remember it was like, I bought a CD burner to burn demos to ship, but back in the mid or late 90s, the blank CDs, CDRs weren't cheap. I mean, they were expensive. So I was like, limited. I was reticent to just hand them out at will. It wasn't like the 2000s where you could, you know, burn a CD for, you know, 50 or 75 cents or something like that.
Right.
And, I remember I gave a demo to Copyright, you know, this is maybe around, I think 99 or 2000 or so. And Copyright was going out to New York. He was one of the rappers in this group. I was the DJ / producer in this group called the Megahertz. It came from Columbus, Ohio. And Copyright and Camus had a connection to, we had done a couple records on Fondalum Records, who was Bob Udo Garcia's label. And Bob kind of knew everybody in the underground hip hop world, of course, because, you know, the Stretch and Bob show was to be on that was, you know, it's Johnny Carson of underground rap at the time, if you will. So Pete was going out to New York, and he's like, let me take a demo to listen to on the way. And I was like, I can't, I don't, I, you know, what if this is, I don't have a lot of these. I'm trying to get a deal doing this. And he's like, I'll play it for Bob. And I was like, okay. And I gave him one, and he didn't, he may or may not have played it for Bob, but he ran into LP, and he ended up playing it for L. And that's how that connection came about. But I came this close to not sending Copyright with a demo when he went on this trip to New York. And if I hadn't, I don't think that connection ever would have been made.
What did you know about LP prior to, I guess, this connection being made? What was his, I guess, situation or impact had been so far in music?
Well, he had that very first Fun Crusher Plus EP. I could be wrong here, but that was on, I can't remember what, it was on another label. It wasn't on Def Jux, if I remember correctly. There was an original, there was the Fun Crusher Plus that got reissued by Raucous, but before that came out, there was a, and I still have it, it's an EP, but it's double clear vinyl. And because I remember this was, I want to say, I'm going to put it right around 1999. I don't think there had been a Def Jux release. I think it had been, this was a thing that he was thinking about doing. He was like, I want to start a label. And his impact, to my knowledge, was just the, Fun Crusher EP. So I was familiar with it, and I had it, and it was, I've told Jamie this story before, but like that record was an exercise in patience for me, because it was so unlike anything that had been out before that. I remember somebody just being like, one of my friends is like, you got to get this record. So I bought it. And I listened to it, and I just didn't get it. You know, I was just like, I don't get, this is just way too out there for me. So I put it on the shelf, and then every like 2 months I'd pull it out and try to, you know, revisit it. And then maybe 4 or 5 months after doing that over and over, it was just like one time it just clicked, and I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. So that was kind of like where that, you know, his origin story for me as it relates to my personal experience.
You released your debut album under Definitive Jux, 2002. What was happening for you personally in music that you wanted this album to be like, maybe a statement in terms of maybe a reaction to what's happening in music, or actually continue the conversation that was happening in music? I guess ultimately, what did you want to get out of, what did you want the yourself to get out of the release of Dead Ringer, but also what did you want the fans to get out of it?
You know, my goal at this point in this is, I think you'd have to have lived through that period of music to be, or more specifically, you'd have to have been a rap fan and a beat fan between 95 and 2000, you know, early 2000s to really understand this. But so in the mid to late 90s, there was this kind of explosion in what people would call instrumental hip hop. You know, previously mentioned labels like Moax and Ninja Tune and Skint and Bomb Hip Hop. And there was another, this space in the Deep Concentration compilations that came out of the Bay. I can't remember what label put those out. Anyway, that was like a thing. And in the world of DJs, it had become this alternative to rap music. So it was fairly common to hear people be like, oh yeah, I really like this instrumental hip hop stuff, but I don't like rap anymore. I hate rap. The reactionary thing, a lot of it to me was associated with like what some people called like the jigginess factor of like, mm-hmm. you know, when Bad Boy got really big, and then, you know, there was Bad Boy, and then there was West Coast. And it was like, for people who went to high school and listened to the Far Side and Black Moon or whatever, that late 90s period, it, a lot of them felt kind of like forlorn, you know, and they had taken on this instrumental hip hop stuff as basically an alternative to rap. They didn't listen to it anymore. So if there was a mission statement behind the record, for me, it was to unify those two things is kind of a corny way of putting it, but it was, I was a person who was like still making rap records and was finding things that I liked and also still into this like instrumental beat thing. And to me, the differences weren't that stark. Neither one was an alternative to the other. There was no war between the two creatively. So I was trying to make a record that was in essence a case study for or like an argument for like the instrumental beat guy to be like, hey, you're missing out on rap music, and vice versa for the rap fan who was like, hey, you know, there's more than just, you know, a beat, a guy with an NPC can do something more than just make a beat for a rapper.
Let's talk about the rapping aspect of that album. And I think you share about Funk Kosher Prush. It's like, I think a lot of stuff for me, listening to your music, it takes me a while to figure out what's going on because, you know, obviously I don't speak instrumental, if that's a term. Sure. But I think what you do is interesting is that on that album, the first time we hear a rapper is the fifth track with Blueprint mm-hmm. On Final Frontier. So as a instrumental fan, but also as a rap fan, why the fifth track, and also why is Blueprint for you the kind of the first MC to hear on this album?
So, you know, I had these at a point, the album as a collection of songs was effectively done, and then it became a sequencing thing. And to me, that was the most sequencing of your first album is there's nothing that's the most relevant and significant time you're ever going to sequence a set of songs, you mm-hmm. know, because to me, you're really trying to lay out an argument for why somebody should listen to the rest of the album, particularly mm-hmm. those first five songs. Every time I've made a record, I felt like I'm going into it on the assumption that I need to lobby people to just finish listening to the record, you know? So that first five song sequence is so important, you know? And each of those songs is selected for kind of like relevant reasons, you know? And so the Final Frontier is where it is because I didn't want, I felt like if I put it any earlier, I'm kind of selling, marketing or selling or whatever, presenting this record as a record that was, okay, here's a guy who makes beats and he needs rappers, like a Funkmaster Flex record or something like that, or like a, because that was a thing that also existed at that point in time, was like, you got a producer and all he knows how to do is make rap beats. So when he drops a record, every song's going to be a feature of, it's going to have a rap feature, and there's no point. What I felt like it was important for me to have a stretch at the beginning of the record that was just me doing my thing with an NPC to kind of sell to people, okay, there's going to be, just set the tone in essence, like I'm going to be working with rappers, but I don't need to be working with rappers by default, And it, at that time I had the three, I had June, Final Frontier, and FHH with Jakai. And I felt like those other two were kind of, they were a little more like topical.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like Final Frontier presented a better mission statement. So that's why it was where it was.
You've talked about in the past, you kind of talked about creative trust between you and the MC and vice versa. And I think you mentioned on the, we talked about a copyright on June and the June remix and how this was kind of a defining moment for you two in terms of gaining this creative trust. Can you tell us how that happened? I mean, how did this creative trust happen? And is that something, I don't want to say obstacle, but maybe obstacle that you've had to overcome a lot in terms of gaining trust of the MC in order to have him or her on any of your music?
Yeah, it probably cuts both ways, and I've been, I'm usually pretty transparent with people that I work with, and I'll just kind of tell them up front, like, listen, I'm going to tell you if you say something that I have a problem with, but don't, I would rather you not box yourself in and go wherever your mind goes and let me be the one that potentially, if needed, needs to reel you back rather than you come in to that creative process, curtailing yourself as to what you might write about or want to say on a record. And Pete just went there. I mean, it was funny too. I'll never forget being in the studio the day that he recorded June, because up to that point, he hadn't made a song that was about anything. I mean, effectively, you got to realize, like, Kamuteo and Copyright were the, Tyson and Holyfield of the battle rap scene in Columbus, Ohio at the time. Like, they were, kind of, there was other guys that were out there that were significant, but I mean, they were known quantities in Columbus as battle rappers. And so they not only had, like, proven their mettle in that world, all the recordings they had made were just showcases around how hard they were going to destroy another rapper, period. That's it. So it was a big ledge for Pete to walk out onto to record that song. And I'll never forget, the day we recorded this guy, Derek, his house, and he didn't tell us what it was about. He just said, I want to record to this beat. Like, okay, we dumped the track in. He went down in the booth. We had no indications of what he was gonna, what he was gonna be rhyming about. And I'll never forget, he did a pass through on the first verse, and me and Derek just looked at each other and we're like, holy shit, this was, he went, not only he took it outside of the battle rap box, but he took it to this like, hyper personal place. So yeah, it was a moment.
From a producer perspective, when that happens, when it's a shock, essentially a shock, what this MC is going to rhyme about, do you still give him or her direction? of like, hey, do that again or whatnot? Or is it something that is so powerful that you just have to leave it as is?
I'm not opposed to it, but at that point in time, it's not, it's just a matter of like trying to get the vision across. So I wouldn't, at the end of the day, I feel like my job as a producer is whatever I see is the driving force or spirit behind the song. I just want it to come through as strong as possible. So, you know, in that scenario, I mean, I didn't do this, but to use, you know, kind of use like a hypothetical example, if I was in that moment and was like, Pete, just let it all hang out, man. If you start crying in the middle of the verse, that's fine. It's probably going to benefit the song. I'd feel comfortable saying something like that to a rapper, right. You know, cause it's like once it's done, it's, you know, it's a time capsule. It's sealed. You want to do it as whatever you're doing, you want to do it as intense as possible.
I want to ask that quickly about labels. You know, in 2002, you released Dead Ringer, and 2004, you released Since We Last Spoke, both solo projects under Definitive Jux. But in 2003, you released 8 Million Stories. In 2006, Things Go Better with RJ and AL, Al, both projects released under Rhyme Sayers Entertainment. How did that work? What's the benefit and the setbacks of being able to release projects over different labels?
I see only benefits and no setbacks, frankly speaking. You know, most famously, Wu-Tang used this strategy. You know, very obviously, Wu-Tang was signed to Loud, and then they went and, you know, when it was time for each member to do a solo project, they effectively dispersed and ended up on a bunch of different labels. And there's a logistic advantage to that. I found the same, you know, for Soul Position to be signed to Rhyme Sayers and for me to be signed to Definitive Jux. And I was never signed to Chocolate Industries, but, you know, the first Diverse record, I did a bunch of production on that. That record came out on Chocolate Industries. There was Decon that put out the AC Alone record. Having these different relationships is just kind of diversifying your assets to me. So, it's only a benefit in that you want, number one, you get to see how different businesses work. Mm-hmm. And number two, you're getting access to maybe not entirely different crowds, but potentially different crowds. You know, in a perfect world, there's people who only follow ABB records and they only follow Stone's Throw and so on and so forth. And so as much as you can access those different fan bases, I think any artist is better off doing it.
When you composed A Beautiful Mind, which would later be used in Office of Famous Story as the ABC's, AMC's Mad Men theme song, what did you originally have in mind for it prior to it getting picked up for this to become a theme song?
You know, I had no... me and AC Alone were just trying to make a dope record. As simple as that, man. I don't want to like upsell or downsell it. I just, you know, just to tell you the truth, you know, we were set ourselves on the path. You know, I'd worked on his Love and Hate record and it was fun to work with it. He's always been one of my favorite rappers. To me, he was like the Pharoah Monch of the West Coast. You know, I'd always been a huge fan of his. And so I was honored to work with him on the Love and Hate record. At that time, maybe 2004, 2005, my life was just a madhouse. It was just like constant touring, recording, remixing. Time was the resource I just didn't have much of. So it actually took a bit of discipline for me to buckle down, even though I really, really, really wanted to make a full length album with him. We'd been talking about it for a while and he was kind of getting, I think he was getting irritated. I was like getting pulled in 9 different directions. And so he's like, listen, man, we're either going to stop talking about this or we're going to make the record, but we're not going to keep talking about this potential project forever. And I was like, okay, cool. So I could just cleared the schedule and buckled down and made it. And at that point, you know, he had made it clear to me. That's a good example of, he had made it clear to me. He was like, listen, nothing's off creatively, tempo wise, nothing's off limits. Send me all of it. And I was like, okay, cool. So when I was making beats for that record, I was kind of purposefully going all over the map, which is fun to me. That's my comfort zone is doing that. So, you know, Beautiful Mind just became one of those. It was just one other song in a record. I think it could have been anything in there that I was just trying to make something that was dope. And, you know, and the beauty of working with AC is that I don't think I could have sent a track like that and had it accepted with a lot of rappers. And that's not mm-hmm. to slight anybody. It's just, you know, because of the fact that it's so fast and it's so kind of frenetic, you know, it takes a lot to kind of feel comfortable rapping on something like that. And then they, you know, what happened is we put out the Magnificent City album, put out Magnificent City instrumentals maybe 4 or 5 months after that. And A Beautiful Mind got played apparently on an NPR spot as like bumper music. And if I remember correctly, you know, it was heard by the developer of the show and he said, I got to have it. And that was that.
Was there any, prior to it, was there any hesitancy for you guys to, I guess, let Mad Men use it as their theme song? I mean, did you have to weigh like the benefits and, you know, call, you know, curse?
I did. And it was a, you know, I was the, Peter who runs Decon and AC and myself, there were three, you know, interested parties that had to sign off on it. And I was more reticent than they were. You know, if they hadn't really kind of leaned on me, I think I wouldn't have, you know, probably, I it's entirely possible I would have passed up that opportunity. So, you know, this is just, you look back on a career and it's like this, or a life. I mean, it's not, I think this applies to everybody. It's just like, you know, things just happen a little bit differently. Your life could be radically, you know,
right,
somewhere else.
You know, as mentioned, you've done so many projects and you've remixed tracks as well of different artists. So I kind of want to quickly ask you about a few of these artists and sure. What drew you to collaborating with them, but also what kind of makes them unique to you. So we can start with Mos Def.
Oh, on the Wildin' Out remix.
Yes, sir.
I mean, in the Black on Both Sides record is a bona fide classic to me. I feel like my perception was he was top dog in the raucous era of rap. So, you know, being able to be a part of a project that he was on was, you know, it was just something I couldn't pass up.
And you already talked about him a little bit, but AC alone.
Man, you know, I'll never forget the first time I heard the Inner City Griots record, the Freestyle Fellowship record. I was just like, these guys are on a whole other planet. I mean, it was just mind blowing to me what they were doing with their voices. And AC was like the, you know, he was like the pasta noose of the, I mean, that's a bad way to put it, because Dove is like equally as talented, but you know what I mean? He's like, he was like the natural front man of the group, if there was a group. Mm-hmm. And, you know, also the All Balls Don't Bounce record was just a classic, and his ability to just take anything that you threw at him. And he had this like just amazing, his command of rhythm. I, for me, he's up there with Pharoah Monch of guys who their command of rhythm with their voices is, it feels like it hits like an instrument to me. It hits like, a Max Roach or a Thelonious Monk or something. And it's just so well executed. So, you know, precise isn't the word, because it just feels great the way he places his syllables over a beat. Even if you didn't understand the language at all, I just think it's beautiful.
Blueprint. But I said Blueprint. Murs, I'm sorry.
Oh yeah. Oh, Murs is he's just a great dude. And he was, you know, at the time he was on Def Jux, and so that kind of like, that was one of those records that felt like a family affair. Mm-hmm. You know, super easy to work with. You know, we had been on tour, and man, it's a little hard to put into words with him, because he's kind of like an everyman rapper to me in a way. You know, that just felt like a family affair.
Cage.
That was the Eastern Conference connection came through. So Pete, Copyright's first record was on Eastern Conference, and you know, he was, what was that record? He had the, man, my mind is, my memory is just not what it used to be. It had the, Clockwork Orange loop.
What was that?
I can't remember that. He had that 12 inch out. There was it Stony Lodge? I can't remember the name of the record, but it was, I can hear it in my head. He's rhyming over that loop of the, from the Clockwork Orange, soundtrack. And, you know, he was in that camp of the Eastern Conference guys. They were all a little wilder than the Def Jux guys in my experience. A little rowdier. And, but we had also been on tour. So, you know, so I had a familiarity with him there, and, you know, he's just dope rapper. It's like, hey, let's, you know, let's, I'm making this record. Send me what you got. And, you know, off we went.
I have to ask you, of course, about Tame One.
You know, Tame was a wild one as well. The whole Eastern Conference, you know, he was always real cool to me. You know, coming out of the pedigree of the Artifacts, it was like, it was dope to be able to be part of a project with a group that, you know, again, in kind of like underground rap, had some, you know, classic records under their belt. So that one was like, you know, I think he had a deeper catalog and a bit more of a pedigree than most of the guys on EC. So, you know, that was an honor to be asked to be part of that.
This is the last one, just in terms of asking you, because I went to high school with him, J-Live.
Oh man, you know, that's wild. You went to school with him. J-Live is one of those guys that's like, he's just such a warm, good soul. You know, he's just like a super nice guy. And being in hip hop, sometimes there's like a situation where it's like you meet somebody and you're not exactly sure what their intentions are, and he's kind of like gotta, you know, might take you a second to feel him out, but he's one of the few guys that I feel like just instantly from jump, I was like, I can trust this guy for whatever reason, you know, and he's super dope. I'll never forget. We played a show together in, I think it was like NYU or something. And he did the Bragging Rights thing where he like does the back to back on the, with the doubles of the record, and he's DJing and rhyming at the same time.
Yeah.
And I had to go on after him, and I was like, oh no, this is terrible. I want to do this. So yeah, you know, just super, super, super dope MC, great guy.
You know, as mentioned, you've released so many projects, and the fun ones being your latest. In a review, it said it was assembled in part using conversations from some of your contemporaries, including Fonte, Coleman, J-Zone, Kid Cola, Mr. Lift, and Sun Little. Can you kind of talk about what that means and what were these conversations you were having?
Yeah, so when I finished this, the recording of this record, you know, I wrapped up the songs, and they were completed, and then I mastered them. So that was all wrapped up. And then the idea popped into my head of trying to assemble the record like a mixtape. And I didn't think that it was going to be a good idea to, you know, just go out, and it's just not realistic for me to go hog wild on Jack and acapellas from like Richard Pryor records and stuff. You know, like in the back in the day, if you're going to make a mixtape, it would be a thing that was like, yeah, you're going to make 500 copies and it's going to be, you know, it's not the same thing as making a record. But I was like, it'd be great if I could assemble this like a mixtape. So in this day and age, I was like, why don't I just, you know, record some voice conversations with people that I know and cut those up, look for kind of, you know, audio snippets out of those. And then, you know, that's free and clear. So that's what I did. And as soon as I did the first one, I realized I was, able to put like a theme around it. So that theme became one of the things that had been marinating in my head while making this record was, you know, I turned 44 this year. There's a point at which I feel like you gotta, if you've been doing it as this over 20 years, there's a point at which you're like, well, you know, why are you doing this in the way of like, oh, you should just quit, but like, there's got to be something more driving you than just you're paying the bills, right? You know, and so that was a thing that I had been marinating in my head for a long time. So that was became the question that I would present to people. You know, I'd call and say, hey, you know, what's your, because all the people that you named there, they've been making, they're all my peers plus minus probably 2 or 3 years. And, you know, there is, I feel like it's a natural thing to, you know, it's in the same way that like you can understand a midlife crisis for a guy who took a career on at early 20s or something. He's been working right. a job for 20 years and he's like, what am I doing with my life? Is the nature of a midlife crisis that makes it, you know, a lawyer go buy a Corvette or whatever. I think a similar thing can happen to people that work in the creative arts, you know, at this age. So that's what, that became the question that I was asking people. And so that is what gave the themes, gave the conversations and the audio snippets a singular theme.
How does the horns, the drum, the guitar on the first track, No Helmet Made Up, Indianola, how does that work as the table setter or support the theme of this album?
Yeah. It's a good question. It did feel to me like I was trying to select a tune that set the tone for the record, and why I picked that tune. I don't know. For some people, this might sound like I'm reading way too into, you know, instrumental music, but you know, each song, kind of the beauty of making instrumental music is that each song can have a feeling or a tone that doesn't reduce down to words very easily. You know, one of the things that I've loved about instrumental music is it can illustrate an emotion that you can't necessarily put into words. And with that tune, it was, it's hard to put into words, but I felt like it, you know, harmonically, rhythmically, arrangement wise, tonally, the instrumentation that's used, it felt like it was the best tune to kind of tell the shape of things to come throughout the record.
Homeboy Sandman's featured on One of a Kind. What is it about him that he brought to this track that maybe very few, and no disrespect to any other MC, but very few MCs could actually bring to a track that this kind of track?
You know, I sent him a number of tracks in, you know, in typical rap fashion. You know, I send everybody a number of tracks to choose from. I'm not like, hey, this is the song. You know, with this record, I did send people stuff and be like, you know, here's a few things to choose from, but I would prefer you chose this one because it's going to work. But, you know, at a point I started seeing the layout of the album and right. how it was, you know, where it would be best to have rappers. And what he, you know, I think what he does best is what him, you know, for me, what gravitated me towards how he rhymes, and this had been, you know, kind of years back, is that he utilizes space in a bar in a way that I don't think I've ever heard a rapper utilize. Like, he's very comfortable not saying anything. He's like, kind of like the Miles Davis of rappers, if you will. It's like, you know, what the notes that he doesn't play end up being the most significant in a way. So like, he'll leave these huge gaps of space in a lot of his rhymes. You'll hear him do it. And it's dope. You know, it exudes confidence, but it's also, it does a number of things. You know, it makes it easier to understand what he is saying. But it just gives it kind of this, like, I found that like, if a rapper is just, you know, flowing like a very predictable pattern throughout a whole song, it's kind of easy to tune out, and mm-hmm. and unless what he's saying is so captivating, but space is, and you know, for him, I think it's a great way to kind of suck you in and kind of make you listen more.
You know, we're talking obviously in during a time of you know, global pandemic, and I was curious, was there any hesitancy for you to release this album now? I mean, did you knowing full well that you can't go on tour, right? I mean, you can't.
Yeah.
You're not going on tour. Was there any hesitancy to release it now? Were you thinking about shelving it maybe for a few more months to see where we would be in a few more months, or why? I guess why now? Why'd you release it now?
It's funny. I had a conversation with my label rep. This was maybe, so the record came out April 17th. Is that right? I think it was 16th, 17th. Yeah. And this conversation was, the pandemic had been about, we were about maybe 2 weeks in, and we had realized, I think it was the last week of March, and we had realized like everything's shut down. Like at that point in time, it was full blown. This wasn't like, oh, there might be a pandemic. This was like businesses are closing, you know, governors are giving, you know, shutdown orders. And I was on the phone with my label rep, Paul, and he was like, you know, I'm really glad that you decided to just push forward with this record and release it and not like push the street date because you're not going to be able to tour anything. I laughed because it was like, when he said it was the first time that I realized that was an option. I was like, mm-hmm. Should we push the record back? and I was like, well, it's too late to do that. But I didn't even, it wasn't, even as he said it, it wasn't really appealing to me. You know, and you know, I felt like in a way it's kind of, it's in keeping with this, you know, what we were talking about earlier with like the mission statement behind this record and the thing that I would present to the people I was talking to for the audio snippets. You know, when I ask myself why I'm still making music outside of it's what I'm best suited to feed my family doing, it's that I really do. I feel stronger and stronger about, you know, the older I get, that giving back to humanity, this is like the best tool that I have to do that. So, you know, there is kind of like a sense of purpose that for me exists around making music and making recordings and you know, those are the things that when I'm gone will be left behind. So in keeping with that spirit, it just felt right for me to, you know, put the record out. 'Cause yeah, it might be a smarter move to, it could have been a smarter move to hold it financially speaking, but I don't think that creatively or what I'm gonna, you know, in a way, I feel like I'm in a race to jam to put out and create as much music as I can while I'm still alive, for those reasons. You know, if I look at like given on a 1-to-1 basis, if I were to go be like a, I don't know, whatever else I was going to do, I don't think that I would have the, you know, to use an analogy, like the vectors of transmission that I would have in music, because I'm, you know, I'm so thankful and lucky to have the platform that I do, that I can reach hundreds of thousands of people. I don't think I could do that doing anything else.
The new album, The Fun Ones, he's RJD2. Thank you so much for being on The Library with Tim Monagill and allhiphop.com. I greatly, greatly appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
A lot can happen between falling in love with a house online and owning it. Between imagining living there and breathing in your new home for the first time. Having an advocate who can help you navigate the complex world of financing, inspections, negotiating, analyzing the market, and talking through any anxieties that may pop up, that can make all the difference. That's what the expertise of a Realtor can do for you. Realtors are members of the National Association of Realtors and bound by a code of ethics. Because that's who we are.
Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at Curology.com/SXM. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation, subscription required. Cancel anytime.